Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of The Dissenter. I'm your host, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. Gustavo Carlo. He is Millsap Professor of Diversity in the Department of Human Development and Family Science at the University of Missouri. His research areas and interests include prosocial and moral development among children and adolescents, temperament, family correlate, social cognition and emotions, and culture-related variables associated with such development, and positive health and adjustment among Latino families and youth. He's also been the recipient of several awards, including the 2017 Top Faculty Achiever from the University of Missouri and the 2018 Outstanding Mentor Award from the Society for Research on Adolescence. So, Dr. Carlo, thank you a lot for taking the time to come on the show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Okay, so we're going to talk basically today about pro-social and moral development and children and adolescents. Perhaps the first question I would like to ask you is, why do we talk about moral development and pro-social development? I mean, are they two different things? Are there situations where perhaps morality is not pro-social? I mean, why is there a distinction?
Well, that's an excellent question to start things off. It really has to do more with tradition, and it has to do with the history of the study of morality. And I think the two concepts of morality, pro-social behaviors, pro-social development, have not traditionally been intertwined. And perhaps, it's somewhat unfortunate because, in fact, if we think about if we all sort of sat back and talked amongst ourselves about and asked what is morality, eventually we would probably all come to pretty much some agreement that morality has to do with pro-social development. It has to do with wanting people to be people of good character, people that are considerate of others, that are just, that are fair, and all those notions of fairness and justice and rightness and goodness and all of those things are exactly what pro-social development is all about. So I think the term morality has just been around longer than the term pro-social behaviors. And in fact, the term pro-social behavior was a term that was really developed much later in the history of the study of morality. And within the field of psychology, I think if we look back to the early days of psychology and the study of morality, there was quite a bit of emphasis on sort of immoral behaviors and immoral development, and less so emphasis on moral or pro-social development. And so I think where we're at right now is that we're in a period of time in our history where, in the study of psychology, we have come to understand that it's really important to understand sort of the positive side of morality, as well as the negative side. But that in the end, what we're really mostly interested in is trying to understand how we can improve morals of our society, how we can teach our children to be good pro-social individuals, persons, and ways of sort of hopefully addressing some of the major challenges that our society faces right now with respect to morals.
Okay, I understand. So, one of the things that got me very interested in your work is the fact that it seems to me that you're very interested both in perhaps the innate and the acquired or environmental or cultural aspects of moral development and pro-social development. And it's very interesting to me because I've been having a lot of behavioral geneticists and evolutionary psychologists on the show. And I mean, there's those two sides of things. On the one hand, it's true that we are, evolutionarily speaking, a pro-social species, and so we are born with certain tendencies toward pro-sociality, let's say, broadly speaking. But on the other end, we also have some environmental influences going around, including cultural ones. How do you deal with both of those aspects in your work?
Not well. That's the short answer.
Okay.
I don't think in general we as a field deal with these aspects in adequately. And in part, to be fair, that's because I think the study, especially the study of pro-social development, is relatively more recent. It's more, much more in its early stages, in its infancy. But I think, I absolutely, one of the reasons I am very excited about and passionate about the work that I do is because it really does directly get at one of those core big questions that scholars have debated for centuries and, across all disciplines, about the role of nature versus nurture. And I think the study of morality, the study of pro-social development is an excellent conduit for the study, for understanding the role of nature versus nurture. In the end, of course, most of us probably agree that both play major roles, and the research certainly backs that up. That when we look at the genetic makeup of pro-sociality, of empathy, and pro-social behaviors, sharing, donating, generosity, kindness, all those sorts of things, that there is, somewhere between 40 and 60% genetic variance that accounts for those behaviors. Which means that, of course, the other half of it is probably environmental and cultural. I mean, I think that the evolutionary psychologists, the biopsychologists are absolutely right. The behavioral geneticists are absolutely right. We have these sort of predispositions that we inherit from our biological, it's part of our biological legacy. Capacity for both pro and antisocial behaviors. Both are important in terms of survival of species, and actually probably important also survival of the individual, of individuals. But clearly the capacity to be both pro-social and antisocial is something that I think our environment plays a major role in shaping and molding and sort of channeling, so to speak. I think the I hope we're sort of past the some of the sort of archaic notions that some individuals are born evil or some individuals are born good. I mean, we're born for both capacities, and then sort of the way I think about it is that, right from the start, individuals, persons are, born into a certain environment, and there is still, of course, lifelong influence from our genetic sort of our wired makeup, our dispositions, but those can clearly be I think, shaped and molded, and you can encourage or discourage, you know, pro-social, antisocial tendencies in individuals. We obviously are not at a point where we can absolutely, you know, say for certain how these things play out, and certainly we can't say for certain how these things play out on an individual level. But it's definitely the case that there is influence from both nature and nurture, and those influences we need to come to understand at some point how those things continuously interact with one another, how they sort of influence one another, and ultimately how they help us to understand and predict how humans behave. So that's the big, you know, $1 billion question, or $2 billion, or whatever amount of money we want to put on it. But that's what also what makes it so challenging and exciting to do this kind of research, because I think there's plenty of room for all kinds of influences and forces that are impinging and impacting us and really guiding the way we behave and interact with others.
Right. So, since we're talking about developmental psychology, I would like to ask you if there are any well-defined or fixed developmental stages in pro-social behavior, because as far as I understand it, there has been for a long time a debate in developmental psychology if the approach of trying to divide development in several different stages is really the correct one or not. And right. So perhaps this question would be in two parts. The first part, if you agree with that approach, and the second one, if we have stages for pro-social behavior or development.
Okay, I think I can handle that one. the first part, the short answer is I don't buy into the idea of stages and stages of development, and I think the research backs me up on that quite a bit. But to say that there are no stages doesn't mean that these things don't develop. They are developing, and they're constantly developing, and that's one of the reasons why the stage notion doesn't really work, is because the stage notion in some ways places unnecessary rigidity in terms of understanding how people progress, so to speak, from one phase of development to another. To begin with, we know now that children, very young children or infants, even infants and babies, they're not totally selfish. They're not totally selfless either. they are capable of some. They demonstrate some evidence of pro-sociality early on. And of course, they demonstrate some evidence of, for lack of a better term, what we would call aggression or sort of hostility or anger or those sort of precursors to antisocial behaviors. But that's what we see early on, is that what we really see are these sort of precursors or these antecedents or these sort of preliminary evidence of what would eventually, could eventually develop into clear pro-social tendencies or clear antisocial tendencies. So for example, empathy is one of those capacities that infants are demonstrate. For example, even when they're born, they have the capacity, what we call emotional contagion. So they can sort of mimic emotions that they're exposed to, whether it be another baby crying and distress, or the mother's own facial expressions of sadness. The infant is perfectly capable of mimicking those emotions, and that's got to be an important prerequisite for empathy, what we would then call empathy, which is by definition matching emotions of in others. And empathy then eventually develops with cognitive development and with the child's ability to increasingly self-regulate their emotions, their arousal, for example. That will eventually blossom and develop into what we call sympathy, which is the ability to feel concern or sorrow for someone else. And then sympathy then is, and some people call it, there's lots of different terms out there. Some people call it empathic concern. There's all kinds of terms out there, but there's no need to confuse ourselves. Sympathy, though, is obviously something that we know is strongly linked to pro-social behaviors. It's also strongly negatively linked to aggressive behaviors. So it inhibits and mitigates antisocial behaviors, and it seems to facilitate pro-social behaviors. It's not the only predictor of pro-social or antisocial behaviors, but it certainly is a pretty reliably consistent predictor of those kinds of behaviors. And it's a very important sort of concept that develops. And again, it has both a genetic basis to it as well as the environmental sort of basis to it. So in terms of pro-social development, that's one thing that develops as the child gets into adolescence. Those abilities become even more sophisticated. For example, instead of sympathizing with one individual, the child with cognitive development, they can sympathize with multiple individuals. They can sympathize with the plight of a group of individuals. They can and so those are skills that continue to develop over time, and that in turn also facilitates more sophisticated forms, excuse me, of pro-social behaviors. Pro-social behaviors directed towards a group in the abstract rather than a group that is, that they're face to face with, and so on and so forth. So that's one major sort of aspect of pro-social development. There are other aspects of pro-social development that we could talk about that change over time, because there are, for example, social cognitions, moral cognitions that also change over time. I could certainly talk about those if we wanted to. Sort of to bring it to a little bit of a close, we also know that the kinds of pro-social behaviors also change over time. And I sort of gave you a little clue to that with the previous example of a child that can now sympathize with a group of people and therefore engage in pro-social behaviors that helps groups of people rather than just individuals. So there's a lot of development that's happening.
Right. So just before we get into how social cognition changes over development and to social cognitions, as you say, let me just ask you this, because we're talking about very early stages of development in children, and there's a very important ingredient here that I think has to do with gender. Is it the case that there's some sort of major differences between boys and girls and male and female babies in terms of pro-social development? Because I know from the literature that there are some differences, like, for example, male babies don't tend to look as much at people's faces as female babies do, and they don't tend to smile as much, and when they get at 2 or 3 years of age, they start exhibiting rough and tumble play, and I guess that would also play a role in the development of their pro-social behavior, pro-social tendencies. So I don't know if all of what I've just said is important to the picture that we're trying to paint here or not, but yeah. Are there any real major gender or sex differences in terms of pro-social development?
Well, of course, nothing is simple. So gender absolutely plays a role, and it plays an important role. What's interesting about gender, though, is that a lot of the way in which gender expresses its impact on pro-social development is once again shaped by the child's environment and the child's culture, and so we need to be really careful when we interpret some of these findings, because as I said, alluded to earlier, as soon as the child is born, as soon as that baby comes into the world, into that culture, there are forces that are immediately shaping and impacting that child's pro-social development. And those forces are gender specific. They're not just cultural or societal specific, because we know that there are also culture group differences. But gender is, of course, part of culture. And so gender role development, gender role socialization is occurring immediately as soon as that child enters the world. And once the child is labeled a boy or a girl, whatever cultural norms, gender norms, are a part of that child's environment, that child is already learning those norms. So what's interesting is that a lot of that research, first of all, a lot of that research has not been conducted in different cultures. So, as we know, a lot of the research in our discipline is conducted mostly with white European American babies in white European American families, and typically in middle class white European American families. So, what may be the case for those babies that they study in those projects may not necessarily generalize to others. Now, I don't conduct research on infants myself, so this is just my own sort of hesitation, I guess, scientific skepticism, maybe, perhaps, because until I see research conducted with diverse samples and actually looking and comparing across diverse samples, I'm not going to be totally convinced by some of those findings. I am convinced in the sense that I believe that those findings probably generalize to those specific populations or samples that have been studied in that research. But I'm not so certain whether those would generalize across other cultures. Having said that, I will say some things that I do know from some of the research that we've conducted with preschool children. And with preschool children, when you connect these kids to psychophysio measures, equipment, when you look at their heart rate, you look at their arousal sort of intensity, physiological arousal intensity, and so forth. And you place them in front of a SAD-inducing, you know, some sort of video clip or something that's sad, you know, that induces sadness in children. What's interesting is we actually don't find any significant differences between boys and girls in psychophysio responding to those sad films. We do see those differences, however, when we look at things such as their facial expressions. So their expressions of sadness or empathic expressions of sadness, concern, do differ by preschool age, and their self-reports of sadness differ between boys and girls. So that research, to us, it suggests that part of what's happening is that boys are learning quickly to suppress those emotions, especially those passive negative emotions like sadness. Obviously, they're not taught to repress or suppress anger, you know, strong negative emotions, but they are taught quickly to, and they learn quickly that it's sort of less appropriate for them to express sadness. And the opposite is true for girls. Girls learn early on that it's inappropriate for them to express anger emotions. And you mentioned rough and tumble play and those kinds of behaviors. Those are usually labeled as inappropriate for girls to engage in and express. But those are more acceptable for boys to express. And then we also see that gender differences in some areas seem to also intensify over time. That is, the gender differences become somewhat larger over time, which I think, and other scholars think, that that's also due to socialization forces, that, you know, especially as they get into early adolescence, when they're interacting with peers and they're, you know, trying to fit in with the group, and they're also their identity, their self-concept development is, you know, becomes a major developmental milestone. I think as that occurs into early adolescence, then gender differences also seem to intensify. And so we see more and more gender differences. Now, one last thing I should say about all this is that even though we see gender differences, the gender differences themselves are not very strong. They account for some variance, and it's important variance. It's important that we take it into account, that we consider it. We should not ignore it. But it's also clear that that gender in and of itself is plays a, you know, relatively small role, especially as compared to other mechanisms of influence. Mm-hmm. So, not sure if I answered your question, but maybe I did, maybe I said too much, but but that's sort of my own take on, at this point, I think, in terms of looking at the gender difference literature. You know, I do think that, as I said before, some of these gender differences matter, especially because they could translate into gender differences in pro-social behaviors, in specific forms of pro-social behaviors or moral behaviors. And we do see gender differences in specific types of pro-social behaviors. So it's certainly the case that gender differences in empathy and other sorts of predictors could help us to understand why there are gender differences in specific types of behaviors as well.
It's interesting that at a certain point there you refer to the fact that it seems that over time gender differences intensify or get exaggerated. And you refer to adolescence specifically. Couldn't it be that because in adolescence boys and girls have already gone through puberty, that they are also influenced by hormones, for example, and that would be another reason why in that stage of development the differences between boys and girls intensify?
Yes, absolutely. I did not mean to suggest that socialization forces is the only thing. As I said earlier, there's still genetic expressions that could be manifest themselves later in life, and we know that happens. For certain behaviors. So the genetic influence is still there, and actually the genetic influence could also be a reason why it intensifies. But, you know, it, as I said before, it's this sort of complicated interaction, right, between all of these different forces. But you know, there should be no doubt that even if genetic expression and pubertal development also help explain these gender differences, it's also clear that these new socialization forces are also entering into that child's life and having a greater impact on that child's life. The peer group plays a very, very important role in terms of whether boys, for example, will cry in front of their peers. You know, it's unfortunate, but it's part of our, at least, you know, majority society here in the U.S. It is definitely the case that boys do get punished and scorned and teased if they express sadness, if they express these sort of these emotions that are labeled weak emotions. And it's certainly the case that for girls, that's much more acceptable. And actually, in some ways, it's actually more desired because it's consistent with this, with the feminine sort of stereotype, right? So, yes, you're absolutely right. There's no doubt that there's still the influence of genetics and of course, the physiological development that occurs, maturation that occurs during menarche and puberty. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And in fact, we've been sort of trying to do a little bit of work on this in our own research, where we've looked at, first of all, we conducted one of the very few studies that actually looked at the pubertal development and its link to pro-social behaviors. And we found evidence that pubertal timing is related to pro-social behaviors, pro-social development for adolescent boys, but not girls, which is kind of interesting. We've also done some research where we talk about this idea of emotional sensitivity hypotheses, the idea that perhaps as children are undergoing pubertal development and the increased levels of hormones, pubertal hormones, that may sort of increase their sensitivity, their emotional sensitivity, and therefore it may increase their empathic tendencies. I'm not certain that we could say for sure at this point that we have clear evidence for this, but that's certainly something that that I think is worth pursuing as a possibility, that puberty, especially the hormones associated with pubertal development, might actually make children more sensitive. And empathically sensitive. And that, I think, would be a very interesting set of studies that someone should do out there.
Right. So at a certain point there, you referred to peer pressure and the influence that peers also have in pro-social development and perhaps also in terms of gender differences. And one of the things that came to my mind immediately was the distinction that people do in behavioral genetics between the shared environment and the non-shared environment, and how it seems that the non-shared environment systematically plays a larger role in how in influencing people's behavior, let's say, and children and adolescent development, than the shared environment. Do you also get that sort of effect or result in your studies? That is, is it the case that in what you study, perhaps parenting and parenting styles doesn't have much of an influence on pro-social development, at least compared with other sorts of environmental influences?
Another billion-dollar question. There's incredible difficulty with answering these kinds of questions because the way that genes influence an individual's behaviors and behavioral characteristics, there's multiple avenues. It's not just a function of It's not just the direct influence of their own genetic makeup on their, on their behaviors, but there's also these sort of genetic effects that are indirect, some of which are transmitted through their parents or caregivers, but even their siblings, even other extended family members. And then on the flip side, the role of environment and non-shared influences is also, multiple. It's also quite complicated because we're not just talking about the child's immediate environment. We're talking about this child that is embedded in this larger environment, in their community, in their neighborhood, and their household, and their school, and their in their country. I mean, there are cultural norms and cultural expectations that are also that are also transmitted from one generation to another. Now, and these things change over time, which is the other sort of complicated aspect to all of this. And we have subcultures. So we have individuals that are born into certain subcultures within larger cultures. So it's just, I don't know. I guess I just hesitate tremendously when I try to think about how much credit or blame should I put on shared environment versus non-shared environment. I'm just very, very hesitant to sort of choose a side, so to speak, because I just cannot help but constantly think about these sort of ways in which these things are impacting. And then, of course, on top of everything I just said, so you're probably not happy with this answer, but on top of everything I've just said, of course, as I said before, these things are interacting with each other. So it's not as if we can, pull these things out. And actually, the whole idea of shared versus non-shared, that's a kind of a, I don't know, that's kind of a shaky concept to me. I'm not sure it's a concept that I would want to, enable or encourage, because I know it's out there. I know we scholars talk about it, and certainly I'm not an expert, as I said before, on genetics. So maybe I'm just not adequately informed about how to speak of these different sources. But my own sort of perspective at this point is that, I guess, I'm not quite sure where that gets us. And certainly, B, it doesn't seem to really help me for my own research purposes where I would like to get to, which is really just trying to understand these sort of mechanisms. The origins of these mechanisms, of course, are important, but some of these mechanisms that are genetic and biological are more distal than the kinds of mechanisms that I tend to focus on, which I consider to be more proximal. It's not a pretty picture by any means. It's not an exact science by any means, but so far in our research, I have found it much better to try and focus on these, identifying these sort of more proximal mechanisms, trying to make sense about how these more proximal mechanisms are, sort of the dynamic nature of these mechanisms, how they're working and in predicting really behaviors that, I mean, in a very real way, my work is all about the ultimate outcome, understanding the ultimate outcome, which are moral behaviors. So, sorry, I'm not sure I gave you an answer again that you necessarily were expecting, but it's just a very difficult sort of thing for me to speak as an expert to, and I'd much rather sort of focus on the kinds of levels of analysis that I'm much more comfortable with, which has to do with these more intermediate sort of processes.
Yes, I understand. And there's lots of different factors at play, environmental and genetic ones, and many times it's very hard for us to control them and to isolate their effects, right?
Okay. So, yes, absolutely.
Okay, so let's now move on to another topic. Earlier,
sure,
you referred to the development of different sorts of social cognitions, even over the period of development that children and adolescents go through. So could you tell us about that? And what do you mean by different social cognitions?
Sure. Social cognitions, first of all, that has to do with trying to understand children's thinking about across different social domains, different domains of life. So there's the study of cognitive development, which really emphasizes understanding the way children the thinking develops, but not necessarily with regards to their social world. And then social cognitions has to do with children thinking about their social world. In the pro-social moral development literature, there's really been sort of two major social cognitions that have been identified and studied, though there are other social cognitions, relatively less studied, but yet we're finding out that they too are important. But perhaps the most one of the most important ones that has been studied quite a bit is what we call perspective taking or role taking. And that is how children come to understand emotions in others, how they come to understand how other people think, their desires, their intentions. And actually, there is also a form of perspective taking that is visual perspective taking, which is how do they come to understand another person's literal point of view, their visual point of view. But the emotional perspective taking and the social or cognitive perspective taking are the two types of perspective taking that have been most closely linked, conceptually linked, to pro-social behaviors and moral behaviors. It's also been linked to other moral cognitions, and I'll talk about that other one a little after this one. In general, the work of Marty Hoffman, the work of John Flavel, and other major figures in developmental psychology have really taught us a lot about how children do start out as being somewhat self-centered in the way they think about things. They're sort of, thinking about the immediate sort of things. They don't really have a really good sense of this idea that they are a separate entity from others, from their social world. Self-other differentiation, which occurs very early on, but nonetheless, it still takes a little time for that to develop. Eventually they overcome this sort of self-centeredness or egocentrism and acquire this social centrism, this ability to understand the point of view from other people's points of view. That is important for empathy development, and it's also important for moral reasoning development. That is how children think about moral dilemmas, how they reason about and make decisions regarding opportunities to engage in moral behaviors. So understanding other people's perspectives, their point of view, being able to put yourself in their shoes, that seems to be pretty important for moral development. And one thing I should say is that even though children by 6, 7, or 8 years of age are perfectly capable of perspective taking, they're perfectly capable of understanding other people's points of views, that says only about their capacity to perspective take. It doesn't tell us anything about their tendency to perspective take. So once you develop the capacity, we see quite wide individual differences in the extent to which some individuals consistently engage in this perspective taking, whereas others maybe not so much consistently engage in that kind of thinking process. And in some cases, it's still somewhat effortful for some individuals to understand the perspective of others. This also speaks to why all of these things are all interrelated, because unfortunately that's the way life is, complicated, but that's also associated with their self-regulation abilities. And so self-regulation involves, for example, their ability to attention span and attention shifting. So it involves cognitively regulating yourself, being able to attend to someone else's needs, for example, and that's related obviously to perspective taking as well. So that's a really important sort of social cognition that develops, and again they develop by middle childhood, but it continues to develop in terms of as a disposition or as a tendency, which might explain why some adolescents, even some adults, might not be very good at perspective taking. It may not come natural to them. They may not be very considerate of other people's situations. The other one that I mentioned is moral reasoning. And moral reasoning has a rich history in developmental psychology. Jean Piaget was conducted the first systematic study of moral reasoning in very young children. It was work that he did in published in 1932, and really it helped establish moral reasoning as a legitimate sort of area of study. And then it was extended and elaborated upon by Larry Kohlberg in the late 50s and early 60s. And then Kohlberg really added all these, the stage-like, Piaget was a stage theorist as well, but Kohlberg sort of took it to one notch above that in terms of his assumptions about how moral reasoning develops, and that it, you know, consistently, it develops sequentially, it's universal, and there's six stages or six basic stages, the seventh stage, but he never really incorporated the seventh stage. Anyway, don't need to get into all that right now. But the other aspects to the stage assumption was that, you know, once an individual gets to another stage, they're in that stage and there's no regression, there's no skipping of stages. Anyway, all that good stuff. Well, as I said much earlier, I'm not really a stage theorist myself or stage scholar. So I think of moral reasoning as developing, but much more on a continuous sort of gradual level. I also don't buy into all these assumptions about regressions and non-skipping of stages and so forth. Because what we see in our own work is that children develop, gradually develop the capacity for different kinds of reasoning. We call them levels of reasoning instead of stages. How they differ is in terms of their cognitive sophistication, which Kohlberg got right in his theory. But the content of the reasoning actually is something that once they develop it, then individuals apply any level of reasoning at any given moment. So they're not just stuck in one, with using one type of reasoning. But instead, as they get older, they have a wider arsenal of reasoning to decide whether to help others or not, or to engage in some antisocial behavior. The other aspect to moral reasoning that's important to keep track of is that we now have research examining moral reasoning in different domains of morality. There are scholars that conduct research focusing on children's justice reasoning, reasoning about what's just or unjust. There's research on reasoning regarding issues of welfare, and caring for others. There's reasoning regarding fairness and distribution and those sorts of things. So there are sort of different related but distinct domains of reasoning that if you peruse the literature, you would find different scholars focusing on different. In our work, we have focused on what we call pro-social moral reasoning, which has to do with, you know, welfare and the needs of others. In that work, we've conducted that work with children as young as preschool all the way on up to adulthood.
Okay, so let me just ask you one last question, because
sure.
I guess that most of the time, I'm not sure if this is correct or not, but when people talk about developmental psychology, they tend to focus a lot on the developmental stages that have to do with infancy, childhood, adolescence, and I mean, people reach adulthood and that's it, basically. They stop develop there, at least in the mind of many people, let's say. But I mean, do we know if there are any aspects of social cognition in this case that might go on developing through adulthood and old age? I mean, does development really stop when people reach adulthood, for example?
Well, another great question. Development doesn't stop in adulthood, and actually we're very fortunate to be living now in a time when we now know that our brain continues to develop even past adolescence, and there's evidence that there's a significant reorganization that continues to happen, even in...
Yeah, there are people now that say that the prefrontal cortex specifically develops into at least age 25. Some people put it at age 30 or something like that, right?
Right, so that's... Yeah, so once again, yeah, we don't know for sure exactly when it's happening, and it probably varies, most certainly varies across different individuals. Because we also know that brain development is linked to environment. So, which is why you should always stay in school. but yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, the mere fact that the brain is still developing into at least early adulthood or middle adulthood, perhaps, that would suggest to us that moral reasoning and these more higher level kinds of cognitive abilities and tendencies are probably still developing. Because as you mentioned, that's the prefrontal cortex. So that's where all the higher order stuff is happening. That's where all the good, interesting stuff is happening. And if we take a look around and we interact with some of our colleagues and acquaintances, or maybe if we just watch the news, we might see that it looks like some people are still developing and others are not really developing very fast in adulthood. Unfortunately, there's a lag in terms of the research in moral development. I should also say, however, that you know it. So development is probably still occurring, both in terms of social cognitions, perhaps in terms of social emotional development. And I know that in the past, there's always also been sort of some scholars that speak to the idea that it may also be the case that into older adulthood that there may be some, restrictions or limitations that may also start to impinge upon cognitions and maybe even social emotional development. The one thing I would say, though, is that there is some interesting work in older adults that has to do with concepts of wisdom and creativity that I think are probably related to moral development. Now, again, unfortunately, so this is another idea for anybody who wants to do some research on this. Unfortunately, as far as I know, I don't know of any research that directly links the study of wisdom and creativity to moral development. But it is interesting if we think about some of the individuals. I mean, pick a person, whomever you think of as a moral exemplar, someone that you can think of, a historical figure perhaps, or maybe a relative, maybe a grandparent or someone like that. And we think about some of these individuals who demonstrate these incredible abilities to make an impact on our societies. And when I'm talking about moral exemplar, of course, I want to focus on the positive stuff, because there's been obviously the ones that can impact negatively. But those individuals that, you know, again, your hero or heroine, whoever you deem to be someone that exemplifies great moral character, great moral courage, and almost inevitably, you have to also probably attribute some great wisdom, right, and creativity in order to be able to have enacted that or induced that major societal impact and change. So I don't have an answer in terms of what continues to develop, but my gut instinct tells me that it continues to develop, and it probably continues to develop in ways that we haven't really thought about very much, but we ought to think about, because I think, you know, as we get older, you know, it's clearly the case that we still have opportunities to do good to our societies and do good to our communities. And there are many, many, many people who are doing those sorts of things. It would be interesting to do some research in that direction and try to understand what continues to develop, and maybe that would help us to understand how we can still do good things in our communities.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So, Dr. Carlo, just before we go, would you like to tell people what might be some of the best places on the internet for them to find your work?
Wow. Okay. Well, that's a good question. We have a website. Director, founder of a Center for Children and Families Across Cultures website, which you would think that I would memorize our website address, but I'm going to look it up real quick because I haven't memorized it. The acronym is CFAC, C-F-A-C, that's a long. Maybe this is why I haven't memorized it. It's hes.missouri.edu/CFAC, C-F-A-C. In there you'll find our recent work. a lot of our we sort of usually upload work that's much more recent. But that'll give you a good starting point. You can also go to my ResearchGate account and look up my name. You'll be able to access a whole bunch of articles and projects, a list of projects that we're currently engaged in. Those are probably the two best places right now. Yeah, I think I'm on the Social Psychology Network as well, but I would probably start with ResearchGate or our center website, and you can, with our center website, you can email us directly. You can also request copies for some of our measures if you're interested in looking over some of the measures that we use and we have developed.
Okay, so I will be leaving links to all of that in the description box of the interview, Dr. Carlo. And thank you again for taking the time to come on the show. It was really a pleasure to talk to
Well, thank you very much, and thanks for asking those hard questions. That made my day. Thank you.
Well, that's my role, you know. Hi everybody, thank you for coming to my channel and for watching this interview until the end. As you might have noticed, I've been putting out regular interviews with academics and intellectuals from a variety of fields, and to keep the channel sustainable, I would really like to ask you to please visit my Patreon page and to consider making a pledge there. If you don't like Patreon, you also have the alternative of supporting me via PayPal or even Subscribestar. Otherwise, and if you like what I'm doing, please share it, leave a like, and hit the subscription button. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my patrons and people who support me via PayPal: Karen Litzke, Anne Blanchett, Perelga Larsen, Lau Guerrero, Chantel Gelinas, Francis Ford, Hans Frederick Zunda, Brian Rivera, Lucas Tafiniak, Sergio Condriano, Janne Henninen, Herbert Gintis, and my three producers: Izar Webb, Rosie, and Jim Frank. Thank you for all.